Yeah. It's Rational Response Squad. About to hit you in your motherfucking face. It's like they keep telling lies. Why they keep telling lies? Jesus never existed and he's ripping off you guys. You'll read the Jesus puzzle and the faith, the incredible shrieking son of man. Who testaments to scam like that phony ass Koran. Yet they two around like bands, like that whack ass Benny Hinn, Billy Graham, Pope Ben. They some sick and twisted men. Why they lying to the people, trying to turn them all to sheep. The Bible simply cruel, all of Nietzsche's shit is deep. With a rational response, we critique the evidence. In 2006, religion has no relevance. Just a sick and twisted dance, trying to take the pain from death. Osama selling virgins, what the fuck do Christians get? An ascetic came to earth just to make you feel like shit. But you can't die for me, no you can't die for me. Look for me like a witch, go ahead and cry for me. Cry for me. Yo. And this goes out to Rook Sapien, Scientific Mike. Nothing but free thoughts transmitting through the night. Evolution is the record for the evidence we fight. Richard Dawkins, Robert Price, trying to set the record right. On the mic, flow precise, anti-gospel, anti-Christ, anti-ant culture twice. Fuck right-wingers, archetypes, just a bunch of wicked lies. Selling war, selling spies, school of liberties in disguise. Why they checking out our lives? Why they can download this track? Patriots invasion app, we're just trying to fight back. Rational and that's a fact. Why they keep telling lies when religion's a disguise? To take the pain from death and to govern all the people. I'm asking you the questions in the Inquisition sequel. Most rational people look beyond the good and evil. Most rational people, we look beyond the good and evil. My name is Proclaim once again. Chilling out. The Rational Responders, Mike Rook and Sabian, doing big things. Be on the lookout for the upcoming album, Question Everything. You can find it at ProcleanCreations.com. Once again, this is the Rational Response Squad, bringing it to you live and direct.
Join us right now in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com. If you are listening to our live stream, join us in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com.
Welcome to the Rational Response Squad. I am Brian Sapient.
I'm Kelly M78.
I'm Yellow Number 5.
And I'm Razor.
And we are the Rational Response Squad. Today's show is a very important show. This is a landmark show, one-of-a-kind show. We have some leaders in the field of atheism on the show with us today. We will feature the authors of the book, The Fundamentals of Extremism. With us on the line now, we have quite a few co-authors, and we're going to cover, over the course of two shows here, as many things as we can cover in the world of Christian fundamentalism and how it pervades and permeates society and dominates America. You know, we're not going to be able to cover everything, and we do have thriving stick cam room right now. As you may know, our show is pre-recorded, but we allow people to witness our live recording sessions. And so if you guys in the chat room have questions, feel free to ask them at any time. I'm going to include the bio information for all of the guests in this show and abstain from referring to them in the next show in such a lengthy manner because they have such a long list of accomplishments. It's going to take up 5 minutes just to get through it. But give you a little background. Kimberly Blaker is the editor and the co-author of the book, The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America. She's a syndicated writer and columnist, a social advocate, and staunch supporter of the separation of church and state. Her column, The Wall, on church and state and other issues from a liberal perspective, has appeared in numerous news publications. Her commentaries have also appeared in the Detroit Free Press, Detroit News, San Francisco Examiner, and Los Angeles Daily Journal. The Fundamentals of Extremism is based on her award-winning research paper, Christian Fundamentalism, A Growing Danger. Of course, Edward Buckner is on the show with us as well. He is a PhD of Amherst, New York, was the executive director of the Council for Secular Humanism and editor of the Secular Humanist Bulletin. He received his PhD in educational leadership in 1983 from Georgia State, and he formerly served as vice president of communications for Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, the Georgia chapter, and is chair of the 7th U.S. Congressional District Democratic Party. We also have Edward Kagan joining us on the show. He is of Union, Kentucky, an attorney and the son of a Presbyterian minister. He received his degree from the School of Law of the University of Louisville in 1971. He's an Eagle Scout, a former college English instructor, and a U.S. Air Force veteran. He is also head of American Atheists for Kentucky. He is the originator and director of Camp Quest, the first residential summer camp in the U.S. for children of atheists and other freethinkers. He is a speaker, debater, and outspoken critic of violations of church and state. We also have with us Bobby Kirkhart of Los Angeles, California, an independent study teacher of 38 subjects in the adult division of the Los Angeles Unified School District. She earned her BA in journalism from University of Oklahoma in 1965. Her first national article appeared in Christianity Today while teaching Sunday school during her academic career. She was co-president of Atheists United, the largest Democratic atheist organization in the nation, and of Atheist Alliance International. Bobby is now the vice president of the Secular Coalition for America. With us on the line as well, we have Herb Silverman, PhD of Charleston, South Carolina, a distinguished professor of mathematics at the College of Charleston, which he joined in 1976, and is a national board member of the American Humanist Association. He received his PhD in mathematics from Syracuse in 68. He attained the office of notary public in 1997 when the South Carolina Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional the state law that prohibited non-believers from holding public office. For his successful constitutional challenge, Dr. Silverman is president of the Secular Coalition for America. With us as well, we have John Suarez, MD of Newbury Park, California, formerly associate professor of psychiatry at the University of California. He received his MD from Columbia University School of Medicine. He also serves as chairman of the Committee on Education for Americans United and vice chairman of development at the Center for Inquiry West. He has been a longtime social activist. Guys, this is, you know, we're just so thrilled and flattered that you will all be here with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Indeed.
This is a roundtable discussion. So we'll ask questions of specific guests and we'll try to alternate questions. But if anybody has anything that they would like to add to something that somebody else said, please feel free. So Kimberly, we'd like to start with you as the editor and originator of the book. Could you do us a favor and describe the book in one or two sentences?
Well, The Fundamentals of Extremism is an in-depth examination of the causes and characteristics of Christian fundamentalism and its effects on women, children, African Americans, gays and lesbians, education, politics, and American society as a whole.
Excellent. And what led you to write the book?
Well, I was taking college courses a few years ago, and at that time, I had a strong interest in the effects of religion on society. So in my courses, I initially began doing my research papers on the effects of religion and eventually turned my focus to the effects of Christian fundamentalism on society as I started finding that there was a strong correlation between racism and sexism and spousal abuse, child abuse, and a number of other problems. So as I was doing these research papers, I found a number of scholarly articles in a wide range of journals that I ultimately used in the research papers that I was doing. And following the election of George W. Bush and the changes in our political environment, especially pertaining to many of the key issues of the religious right, and then later following the September 11th terrorist attacks, I felt that it was time that this book be completed. So at that point, I decided to find some co-authors to help me write the chapters, and so that they could add their own experiences and research and their own insight into the topics that they were covering in the book.
Great list of co-authors, by the way. A lot of Americans would say that the United States is a Christian country. What do you think the best refutation of this claim is?
Well, America is largely populated by Christians, and many of the early settlers of the nation were Christian. But that in itself doesn't make America a Christian nation. In fact, many of the early of the early settlers that came to America were actually fleeing religious persecution. And while some of them did ultimately hope to achieve the formation of a Christian nation, they didn't win that battle. Many of our founding fathers were in fact deists, and that includes the most prominent founding fathers, John Adams, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and a number of others. They actually opposed Christianity, or at least those particular ones did. And they were, as deists, they believed in a God that created the universe and from that time did not intervene. If you look at the Constitution and even back at the Declaration of Independence, nowhere in either of those documents is there any mention of Christianity. And in fact, the First Amendment of the Constitution forbids the establishment of religion, and the Constitution also forbids religious tests to hold office.
We have a thought in the chat room right now, and I've got a feeling that Bobby and Ed would be pretty good to answer this. Is atheism a religion?
Well, I'd be happy to throw an answer out for that, and I will do so in just a second. I need to say first that the rest of Kimberly Blaker's co-authors all agree that not only did she do the biggest part of the work on this, and I'm proud of all my co-authors, but Kimberly Blaker deserves huge credit for pulling this off, making this book come into existence, getting it published, getting it publicized, getting it translated into Arabic and published in Egypt and all that sort of thing. So we can talk some more about Kimberly Blaker when you want to. Atheism is not a religion. Anybody who says it is not making any sense. Atheism is, if atheism is a religion, then health is a disease. one way of putting it. But atheism is lack of any religion, lack of any belief in anything supernatural. And atheists certainly don't agree with each other on much of anything other than that there's not much evidence that there's any supernatural beings to protect us or tell us what to do or guide us, help us out or hurt us for that matter.
Yeah, and of course, we agree. I thought it would be nice for you to answer the question. And Ed, maybe you can add on, you know, the notion that America isn't a Christian country.
Well, I can. You say you've got 3 hours left in the show, right? I would need that long.
Well, you know, why don't we?
It's a Christian nation only in the very specific sense that Kimberly already referred to. A majority of the people in this country call themselves Christians, so I guess in that sense it's a Christian nation. But that's not what the fundamentalist and other Christians as well mean when they say it's a Christian nation. Most of the time it's not what they mean. What they mean is that Christianity gets preference here, or that the government is officially Christian, or that it was established based on Christian principles. And none of those things are true at all. Not only is the Constitution, as Kimberly's already said, completely free of any God talk. It's in the name of we the people, not in the name of any gods. And that was really the most revolutionary thing about that Constitution.
But Ed, it says in the year of our Lord.
It dates it that way, of course. And as I know you well know, that's the conventional dating method of the day. We have all sorts of conventional dating things that all of us use that don't convey religious belief. Today is Saturday, the day we're recording this at least, is Saturday. Saturday was named after the god Saturn, but nobody who calls it Saturday believes in Saturn as a god, and so forth with every day of the week and many of the months and so forth. It was the conventional, formal dating method of that time, and in fact, it was kind of revolutionary that they didn't just say in the year of our Lord, but also in the year of our revolution. As part of the official dating. What counts is that in the body of the Constitution, they don't invoke any gods, they don't mention Jesus Christ or God at all. They, as Kimberly already suggested, no religious test shall ever be required for holding office under these United States, even notary public in South Carolina.
I'd like to add that there's a lot of very specific misinformation. You have to call it lies about our founders and how things were founded. There's one quote that I got an inquiry about a couple of years ago now, that James Madison is supposed to have said that he hoped we could rule in accordance with the Ten Commandments. Well, the man who wrote me said that doesn't sound like Madison. Well, in fact, the Madison Library had been through the papers and said, you know, this is not only not in his work, it's inconsistent with his work. I was able to trace back the quote to its year of origin. James Madison said that in 1985.
He was a little old then.
He was getting a little confused, I think, by that time, yes.
Hey. Well, that's not the only misquote around. There are lots.
Oh, no, there are many. That's an isolated example.
Right. And I find that constantly in arguments on this topic, that they'll pull up quotes from Franklin, quotes from Jefferson, quotes from Madison, you know, that seem to suggest that they may or may not have been a Christian or whatnot. But, you know, in the end, it really, I don't think does it really matter what they were, you know?
Well, you should make a distinction. Some of the founding fathers, some of the framers were, in fact, Christians, and that's not relevant. What matters is what kind of constitution they created, what kind of government they created, and it was not a Christian one. But some of these quotations are misleading because they quote somebody as being a Christian, and they don't let you know that that, in fact, is not their view about what government should be. Others, though, are false quotations where they say, as Bobby suggested, that Madison said we must have the Ten Commandments as the basis of our government. He didn't say that. He didn't write that. He didn't think that. We have lots of very good evidence that he thought quite the opposite of that. And so some of these quotations are not just misleading in that they suggest the person who's giving you the quotation suggests something that isn't true. Some of them are just lies. And there's a lot of lying going on in the allegedly to benefit Christianity.
Ed, how does the Treaty of Tripoli factor into all this?
You expect me to talk about the Treaty of Tripoli? Are you kidding? No, I have recently become world famous thanks to Richard Dawkins because he cited me as an authority on the Treaty of Tripoli, I'm delighted to say.
And as you've proudly told me in the pre-interview, I believe that's on page 40 of The God Delusion.
Page 40, correct? Yes. Read The God Delusion. It's a wonderful book, and read page 40 if you don't read anything else. The Treaty of Tripoli was actually a lousy treaty. It didn't accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish. It was supposed to bring about peace with, believe it or not, Islamic fundamentalists, with the Muslims in the then called the Barbary Pirates in the Mediterranean, who are attacking our ships and killing our seamen and stealing our goods. And President George Washington sent a guy named Joel Barlow over there to try to negotiate a treaty. They negotiated a treaty. It was agreed to on November the 4th, 1796. Things moved a little slowly then. By the time the treaty was actually delivered to the U.S. Senate, John Adams was the president instead. This was in May of 1797. It was printed in full in English for the entire Senate, and it was unanimously approved by the U.S. Senate. It was printed in newspapers of the day. It was well understood what that treaty said, and Article 11 of that treaty, trying to reassure Muslims, started out as the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. And the point that Dawkins makes about this is that the people of the day, the politicians who approved this, the editors who put it in the paper, the people who read that, nobody was surprised by that. There was no, imagine George Bush and Hastert and all these folks admitting that the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. They would probably pay a terrible price, or at least they'd be afraid they would be. But in 1796, 1797, nobody paid a political price at all because everybody understood this is not a Christian nation. There's a whole lot more to say about the Treaty of Tripoli, and I can talk about it for an hour and a half if you want me to, but I'll stop for the moment.
And that's really going to be the same with every issue we touch. Each one of these issues could be a show all in of itself, but I think what we want to try to do with this show and this two-episode show is to hit as many of these issues as we can to give somebody like a crash course or the Cliff Notes version of many of these important things that Christians say or that we need to be aware of or reasons why we need to speak up. So, Kelly, go ahead.
Okay, why don't we just start by getting your definition of the separation of church and state? Like, what exactly do you think was intended by that concept?
Are you asking me that? Because I'd be
yes.
happy to answer that.
Yeah.
I, to tell you the truth, any of our authors would be entirely competent to answer that question. But I'll be happy to be the one that takes a shot at it first. It's really very simple, and that is that the government doesn't get to make any religious decisions for its citizens, not any. The government doesn't get to decide whether we believe there's a God or isn't, whether we should worship him if there is such a God, whether we should give money to a church or not. It's hard for Americans to even imagine, but throughout most of the history of Western civilization, it was the church and the government were the same. And if you supported the king, you supported the church too. And the king used the church to help get you to do what he or queen or whoever wanted you to do. And in this country, until 1833, well after the Constitution and the First Amendment, we had established churches in Massachusetts, that fine liberal bastion, Massachusetts. Until 1833, you were required as a citizen to pay taxes to support the Congregational Church. People don't understand that the First Amendment didn't apply to state governments at the time. It was only after we had the 14th Amendment, which happened, of course, after that war of Northern aggression, as we call it down here in Georgia. You said I was in Amherst. I used to live in Amherst, but I'm a Georgian, and I live back in Georgia now. After the Civil War, the 14th Amendment was passed, and that amendment says U.S. citizens' rights can't be abridged by any government, the U.S. government or any other government. And that meant that the First Amendment applied to state governments and, of course, to city and county governments. So none of these people get to make religious decisions for fundamentalist Christians or for me.
So ultimately, doesn't this set of rules protect churches from the state as well as the state from the church? And
absolutely.
Why can't Christians and other theists seem to see that?
Well, it's difficult for any of us, Christians and secular humans and anybody else. It's difficult to wrap your head around the fact that your own religious views or irreligious views are not the only possible ones and might not even be the right ones. And that in order to protect your own, and this, the Founding Fathers said this, so this is nothing new or original with me. Any of our authors could tell you this too. If you want your religious liberty protected, you've got to protect mine too. It's crucial. It's not optional. If a fundamentalist wants to have the right to be a fundamentalist Christian or Islam or any other religion, they must, as a matter of practical reality and of decency and consistency and everything else, they've got to protect religious liberty for everybody else. It's hard for anybody who doesn't think about it very carefully to recognize that. And it's not surprising. We're all human beings. We're all human beings. That goes for us secular humanists and atheists and free thinkers as much as it does for the fundamentalists.
I'd like to throw in a phrase here that might be a little more precise. It's not as well known, and I certainly have no problem with the separation of church and state. But the concept, precisely, is the separation of government from religion. Unfortunately, some people think that the separation of church and state has to do with the state's endorsement or prohibition of specific churches. And in fact, no, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, all religion. It's the separation of government from religion, to be technical about it.
If Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, then why did they do it in the 50s when they added God to our pledge and onto the back of our money?
Because they were violating the Constitution when they did it. The courts may eventually get around to pointing that out.
Herb, why do we have God on our money and in our pledge, and is it unconstitutional?
Well, politicians will be politicians, and I think they found, well, in fact, this occurred during the McCarthy era, when this country wanted to distinguish itself from godless communists. It seems if we want to distinguish ourselves from fundamentalist Islam, we should do just the opposite and not put God into everything. But people feel that this is politically helpful to them. And in terms of it being constitutional, according to our Constitution, the answer should be no. But our Supreme Court decides what is constitutional. And I have a concern about some of our president's latest appointments. And if we continue to go in this direction, what used to be unconstitutional might be described as constitutional in the future. And that's what we're working to prevent.
I have a question for Ed Buckner.
All right.
Ed, do you feel that the Christian right is really America's Taliban, as Richard Dawkins has claimed?
It all depends on which aspect of it you look at. Richard Dawkins is one of my heroes, and I would hate to disagree with him about anything. And I do think the fundamentalist Christian right has the potential to be America's Taliban, and has been in some respects. They lack, thanks to our Constitution, thanks to our secular government, they lack the power to do what the Taliban did in Afghanistan, at least so far. The fact that they have succeeded in electing a president of the United States, and as Herb just quite rightly pointed out, succeeded in getting Supreme Court justices getting closer to being able to control the Supreme Court, is a very dangerous and scary thing. I don't think that the Christian right, and I don't really think that fundamentalist Christianity is quite as dangerous right now at this point in history as fundamentalist Islam is. And the difference may have more to do with the maturity of the religion or something like that, but I think in large part it has to do with the power, the very positive and effective power of a secular government in the United States, and of separation of government and religion. Bobby is exactly right that that's a better, the usual description has been church and state, but it's not just churches, it's also temples and mosques and so forth, and therefore religion is the better word. And state is state in the broadest sense, including all governments, not just state governments. So government religion is a better term. Taliban is a little inflammatory and really gets the leaders of the Christian right up in arms, with maybe some justification. It's a little too strong. But are they dangerous? You betcha they are. Have they destroyed some lives in this country? And are they a threat to destroy other lives? Absolutely, they are. Herb, as you said earlier, is president of the Secular Coalition for America. There are a number of very fine organizations in this country that are working towards some important success in this. Secular Coalition for America is one of those. I happen to be on the National Advisory Committee for it, and of course Bobby is an officer in it as well. And it's time, it's way past time to tell you the truth, but at least now, finally, atheist and godless Americans and secular Americans are waking up to the fact that we too need to lobby to have somebody in Washington who represents us formally and officially, and we are very fortunate in the lobbyist that we have there. She's really very, very capable and even-tempered and wise and able to get through to the Congress. So the Secular Coalition for America is one of many organizations that are doing some very important work, and I'm proud to be associated with them for sure.
So, Dr. Silverman, can you tell us a little bit more about the Secular Coalition for America?
I'd be happy to. We're a new Washington-based lobbying organization for atheists, humanists, freethinkers, and all other non-theistic Americans. In fact, Ed said that atheists don't agree on anything other than that we don't believe in any gods. Actually, in addition, I think atheists can agree with the mission statement of the Secular Coalition, because our mission is to increase the visibility and respectability of non-theistic viewpoints in the United States, and to protect and strengthen the secular character of our government as the best guarantee of freedom for all. The seven national non-theistic member organizations are committed to making a political difference in our culture. So when Ed mentioned a number of fine secular organizations, a lot of these organizations have combined to maximize our influence. But to fulfill our mission, we filed under a section of the IRS code that allows unlimited political lobbying. And we hope not only to influence legislation, as we are doing, but to win a larger cultural war. We're engaged in a civil rights struggle that should have begun 30 years ago. And we're hoping to improve the public perception of non-theists, as well as pursuing a particular political agenda. And I think we're about 30 years behind the times. gays, blacks, women, and Jews are still suffering from varying degrees of discrimination. But bias toward them is neither as overt nor permissible as it once was. Most politicians are careful not to denigrate or stereotype them, knowing that these groups have well-organized advocates and constituencies. But now we think it's our turn. For too long, our constituency has been considered politically inconsequential. We're probably the last minority against which intolerance and discrimination are not only permitted, but also promoted by political leaders at every level. And our national member organizations are working in coalition to help change this.
This organization could not have come about without the cooperation of a number of free thought organizations, and that could not have come about without Herb Silverman. He's truly the face of leadership and cooperation in the free thought movement.
A lot of love in the room.
This is Ed Biden. I would certainly agree with that, and Herb deserves huge credit for having pulled that off. It isn't all that easy to get atheists, secular humanists, freethinkers to work together. It should be, but it isn't. And Herb has managed to be amazingly successful in pulling that together.
What's the web address for the Secular Coalition?
The web address is www.secular.org. I might comment that I don't like what the last two people said, because my motto is actually plagiarized from Harry Truman, and that's, it's remarkable how much you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit. So I think a lot of these organizations that formerly have just been competing for their own membership have decided we need influence in the country and are cooperating rather than just internally trying to become the best free thought organization around. And I'm really pleased the way these organizations are cooperating with each other.
And on that, and in that vein, I hope that we can follow in your footsteps there, Herb. And in fact, to illustrate that, we would be more than welcome to be an open arm and an extension or a hand of support for the Secular Coalition for America and whatever we can do. And, you know, to spread the word through our group, our members and the people who listen to our show. And in fact, you know, what can we do and what can the common listener do to help the Secular Coalition for America?
I hope you will go to our website, www.secular.org, and you'll see what we're doing, and you can join our email action alerts. Our fine lobbyist, Lori Littman Brown, could be much more influential with members of Congress if they hear from their local constituents, like your listeners. For instance, there are now openly gay and lesbian members of Congress. There are also non-theists in Congress, but none bold enough to come out of the closet and acknowledge it. You'll see on our website that we just started a contest offering $1,000 to whoever identifies the highest ranking elected official. We're not outing them, but I think we could probably show that there are so few who are courageous enough to come out of their closet. And we want to create an atmosphere in which people can comfortably express their non-religious views everywhere in the country, even in Congress. Now, of course, we can't do this without contributions. Our director lobbyist, Lori Littman Brown, and also our associate director, Ron Millar, are doing a terrific job, and they've taken a significantly lower salary than they were accustomed to because they're so committed to this cause. And our Washington office is located in the basement donated by the American Humanist Association, and we have one desktop computer and one laptop that was also donated. So we really do need more contributions so that we can have much more influence in our country. I know lobbyists generally have been have a bad reputation, but our lobbyists, instead of causing taxpayers to lose money through pork barrel spending, is actually working to save taxpayer money by getting rid of some of these faith-based contributions to churches and other religious organizations. We're also getting some media attention, and the more contributions we have, I think we can get even more publicity. Like our lobbyist, Lori Lippman Brown, has been on the O'Reilly Factor. There have been articles in Mother Jones and USA Today. And in terms of how you can help the Secular Coalition, it's helping the organization, but I think it's helping all of us. So I think these are contributions well worth spending.
Probably people out there listening who are saying, yeah, you know, I'd like to help them, but, you know, what can I give? Maybe 10 bucks, maybe 25. You can go to our website and you can sign up to give us 10 bucks or 25 bucks a month. And that not only gives you a way of doing this more or less painlessly, it also gives our staff and our budget people a way of planning for the future, knowing not just what came in last month, but a little bit about what's going to come in next month. So it's a wonderful way to give, and it's a lot less painful.
It's worth pointing out, I think, and I know that Herb and Bobby would agree with this, if you're thinking about giving $10, realize that 14% of the people in this country identify themselves as non-religious. We're actually a bigger minority than a number of other minorities that have been quite successful with a proper lobbyist and with a proper organizations to support them. So if 14% of the country gave $5 each, the Secular Coalition for America would be rolling in dough. And they would deserve it.
$100 million.
And give us an idea for the people out there who would think about donating, because atheists generally are very skeptical. And obviously, you guys have given us a great case, you know, so far. But, you know, where would donations go? Where does money go specifically at the Secular Coalition for America?
We're all traveling for Herb Silverman, isn't that right?
Well, yeah, my salary is, I'm hoping to get it up to zero sometime. Usually I pay for travel and I take no salary. We have many volunteers from all of the organizations. We only have two paid staff members and we're trying to hire more. We're hoping to get an office sometime in the future. We're also hoping to get something like CapWiz to make sending out alerts more specific and in a better form. So we'll take all kinds of donations, money, help with our organization, because we are a fledgling organization. We've accomplished much more in a couple years than we had anticipated, but we're still behind what the Christian Coalition was when they started. As much as we dislike everything they stand for, they organized, worked together, took over school boards, and became very influential in the country where politicians would listen. We want our politicians to stop ignoring us, and I think the more people that get involved by either contributing money or contacting their Congress people, telling them what they believe or don't believe, the more respect we'll get and the more fear they'll have of us in terms of our numbers and the more influence I think we could have in this country.
Last weekend, I was in a meeting and there was a businessman friend of mine who heard about the Secular Coalition for the first time. He met Laurie, she was speaking, and on the ride back, we were talking about the organization, and he was asking about the budget and their salary and such. And they work really for, by Washington standards, by very little and by much less than they could get tomorrow. And, you know, he got very excited and said, you've got to get them more staff. He wanted to know what they were doing. He said, you've got to get them more staff. They're going to burn out. You've got to raise their salaries. Nobody can live like that forever. People burn out. And I think that's true. And so in order to keep this going, we need a lot of people, and we would love, you know, $1 million contribution, but a lot of $5 contributions will eventually add up to $1 million.
Well, and I think that all of these people are contemplating giving $5 or $10 ought to do that, and $5 or $10 a month is even better. You also ought to support other national organizations, especially, of course, the ones who are part of this coalition, but there's some other good ones as well. So atheists should not sit on their butts and do nothing. They should get out there and do something.
We don't have the fear of hell to scare people to give to our causes, but I think we are very committed to making this a better country, and I think through the political process is a way to do this. Fundamentalist Christians for years had not been paying much attention to politics. Instead, were just in the business of saving souls. They got involved in politics, and they changed the country, unfortunately, for the worse. But right. Now I think we need to be not just philosophical debating clubs about coming up with better reasons as to why we don't believe in any deities, but we need to influence the country politically.
And in lots of other ways, the fundamentalists are a problem. They are still a problem. It's not just a political problem and not just one that a lobbying effort can deal with. And I know that Kimberly Blaker and her efforts to get this book published and out there has led us in this sense in dealing with fundamentalists. We really have to take it very seriously. It's not just an academic question. It's not just a matter of interest to those of us who don't happen to be fundamentalists. It's a very serious matter.
Bobby, as the vice president of the Secular Coalition for America, is there anything that we haven't hit on in the last few minutes that you can maybe add?
I think we've covered it. It's just that you can't say enough how we talk about how the founding fathers of this country, how lucky we are that these people came together. I feel the same way about the Secular Coalition, about our staff, about the other board.
Could you, just for those listening who are maybe listening on their iPod or, you know, off of an internet connection, could you please tell us the groups that have affiliated with the Secular Coalition? Because as I understand, it's 7 major secular groups that were in existence before the coalition began. So could you tell us who they are?
I'd be happy to. The organizations are American Humanist Association, Atheist Alliance International, Institute for Humanist Studies, the Secular Student Alliance, the Internet Infidels, the Society for Humanistic Judaism, and the Freedom from Religion Foundation. We have a couple honorary members as well, the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers, that's our Atheists and Foxholes, as well as the Anti-Discrimination Support Network. And there are a number of organizations that have endorsed our mission statement as well.
Well, and we do that here. How would other, you know, I mean, we obviously have appealed to a wide atheistic audience that's listening, and many are involved in some of these other organizations. Are there requirements for somebody to be involved with the Secular Coalition? What do you look for? Are you likely to call somebody an honorary member if they don't fit some sort of requirement? And I am in a little way thinking of our own organization, but please, you know, tell me a little more.
Well, the organizations that join, they're required to be national as well as non-theistic, and they're expected to contribute in some significant way to the coalition, possibly like 1 or 2% of their annual budget, volunteer for various projects that we have, possibly donating office space or other donations, but and advertising in their publications. So we really want some kinds of commitments because we're all in this together and it benefits all of us. Now, some other organizations that aren't as committed or as solvent still will endorse our mission statement. In fact, to endorse our mission statement, one need not even be non-theistic. And we have some who are for the separation of government and religion and would like to see atheists be viewed as respectable as religious groups are today. that we recognize we should be measured by our character rather than by our professed religious beliefs. So for organizations who might be interested in being a part of the secular coalition but are not qualified at this point to become a full member, you might think about endorsing our mission statement and working with us on various projects. We welcome as many organizations as possible, as well as individuals who are willing to volunteer and contribute to us.
And one last time, before we have to move on back to issues directly related to what was inside the book, you know, I want to tell the audience to visit secular.org and support Dr. Silverman and everybody involved in the organization and all of the different organizations that have joined up with the Secular Coalition for America. And once again, you're listening to the Rational Response Squad. Check out the book, The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com or NewBostonBooks.com. And also check out our sponsor, EvolveFish.com. EvolveFish.com is the rational response to a Jesus fish, as well as being able to purchase all sorts of other products there that will unite you with other free thinkers when you wear your atheistic pride and other people will notice who you are. And you can pick up t-shirts, hats, mugs, books, all sorts of things at evolvefish.com. So check them out today. Mike?
Yeah, getting back to the book here a bit. This question is for Bobby. You authored the chapter, Little Ones to Him Belong, in which you criticize corporal punishment of children. Now, do you see this as really an issue of religion, or is it something more deep-seated?
I think that one of the reasons religion thrives is because it keys into everything we are psychologically and socially. But certainly today, we know from a number of standpoints that corporal punishment of children increases societal violence, is not productive in making the child internalize the values. We know that it's basically a bad idea. And it persists because religious leaders, most notably Fred Dobson, encourage it. It persists because the Bible prescribes it. And it persists because in fundamentalist households, you have an authoritarian structure where explaining to children why something is wrong is simply not considered appropriate. So it is very much a religious issue. That doesn't mean that only religious people spank their children or that all religious people spank their children. But we are in the humanist movement. We've been using the term atheist a lot, but I noticed Ed Buckner's using humanist, and a humanist is a person with human rather than divine values, to use a simple definition. And the movement against spanking has gone back to the humanist enlightenment of the Middle Ages. And humanists have fought to protect children from physical violence throughout the time. And recently, in a very surprising place in Uganda, the Ugandan humanist movement won a victory and had the corporal punishment outlawed in the public school.
I would add to what Bobby said, and her chapter is well worth reading. I think Richard Dawkins has actually expanded and extended her argument some in a somewhat different emphasis, and that is the fact that you can abuse a child, not just corporal punishment. Very much opposed to corporal punishment. I'm glad Bobby is working against it. And I do think it's a deeply seated religious issue. But it's an abuse of a child to say that a child is a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, when in fact the child is not yet capable of making any decision about what their identity, what their religious belief, what their philosophy of life is. It would, of course, be an abuse to call a child like that a secular humanist, too. So I'm not attacking these religions, except in the sense of saying that we need to allow people to develop and come to their own conclusions about what's right and about the right way to live in the world, and not call children Catholic children. Dawkins makes that point, and I think he's right.
Right. We were actually having a discussion amongst our group here earlier today about that. A lot of atheists will say, well, I've deconverted from, you know, Catholicism or something like that. Well, I kind of made the point that some of us never converted in the first place. It was never given to us as a choice. It was never a conscious decision that we made. We were told we were Catholic or told we were Christian. When we grew up, you accept it because your parents told you that this is what you are. And so that's what you figured you are. And, you know, eventually you come to reason on your own. And I wouldn't call that a deconversion. I would call that just, you know,
abandoning religion.
Yeah, something along those lines.
But, of course, I made the argument that converting from, like, you were born an atheist and then you actually left that state to enter a different state. And so in that sense, it's a conversion. But it was a semantics game. I don't know if we really came to a conclusive agreement, although knowing that an idol of mine weighed in and said that there is no deconversion. So I kind of went with it. But it sounds like, Ed, you might disagree. So
we're all born atheists, and I think that conversions occur back and forth, and that many, many, many children, probably most of the children in the world who have an identity as a particular religious view, don't understand what that means and are being labeled that way by their parents and by their colleagues and teachers and others without any rational, thoughtful consideration of what that means.
I always use the term that becoming an atheist from a religion means you revert. You revert to the atheism you were born to. This might be a good time to talk about something, you know, whether parents have a right or a responsibility to teach their children. And I think that I disagree with Ed and with Richard to the degree that children need a community. And I think that our free thought children need to know that they are of a community. They don't need to be told what they believe. They certainly should not be indoctrinated. But they can and should, I think, be given a community of protection to grow up in. And I think one of the reasons that that so many Americans are so religious, I know my daughter's father, when I was pregnant, he was not religious at all, and he suddenly wanted to find a church to raise our daughter in, is that they see, and it's a very poor choice, but they see the church as, and the religious community as help in raising the children. I think it's not very good help, and I think that the free thought community is still working on becoming a better help. But the most important thing when you're teaching your children what you believe is that you give them all the choices and give them all the information and certainly give Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Wiccans the right to give misinformation to their own children, but don't let them keep the children from other information. Children have a right to access to information just as adults.
Certainly agree with that, and I think the key reason that so many atheists that I've known say, oh, I got to send my kid to Sunday school. It's got to get a moral education somewhere. This is a big, big lie and one that we really must contend with, and that is this notion that religion and morality are all that connected to each other. In my opinion, they are strongly, they don't correlate very well at all. And the big lie that they do is what has led many atheists to send their kids to Sunday school. And it's a big mistake. I do agree with Bobby that children need community, and I do agree with her that free thinkers, secular humanists, and so forth should develop ways of educating our children and letting them have group activities and groups that they can identify with. But I agree with her also that we shouldn't indoctrinate or insist on applying labels to any children as to what their religious beliefs are until they have some opportunity to develop and to get educated, to grow and come to their own conclusion. I don't think Bobby and I really disagree.
I think that if any disagreement is a matter of shading.
Comment about religion and morality. I like the quote of a former congressman, a conservative, J.C. Watts, who said, morality is what you do when no one is watching. But by that definition, only atheists can show that they're moral people.
Right.
I like that.
So I think we came to a consensus over here that we like the word reverted. But Ed, did you have any thoughts on using the word deconvert to describe somebody who's left religion? And
no, you know, I certainly think that people can deconvert, because I think that you convert to a religion from a non-religion, that happens to everyone. I don't think anybody's born religious. I don't think anybody's born with clear ideas about any of this. I don't mean that. I don't think they're born as a thinking, committed secular humanist or freethinker. They're just born without ideas about God. Those are implanted by their culture, their teachers, and most especially by their parents. And when somebody becomes a thoughtful modern-day secular humanist, freethinker, atheist, etc., they, most Americans at least, they're fairly likely to have deconverted from some other religions. I don't care about these terms. It doesn't
yeah,
matter.
Neither do we.
Is a good one.
Neither do we. And in fact, let's move on. Kim, how would you say The Fundamentals of Extremism is different from other books on Christian fundamentalism or the religious right?
Well, there are actually a lot of good books out on Christian fundamentalism and the religious right. A lot of them focus on perhaps one specific topic. I think the way that this book is different is that first it examines the movement as a whole, but also covers the way that all of Americans are affected by the movement, whether they are mainstream or whether they're within the fundamentalist movement. And this is accomplished in the book by providing more than just the opinion of the authors. We have a lot of hard-hitting facts, and we've included numerous sociological and religious studies that have been conducted by published scholars on these various issues. But at the same time, we've also written it in layman's terms as an exposé so that it's readable, not like reading a textbook.
I would like to add to that that thanks to Kimberly Blaker, there is a long list in that book at the end of the book or near the end of the book of additional sources. So if you want to read some more books, start by reading Fundamentals of Extremism and then read the list in the back.
Kim, who do you think is most affected by fundamentalism? Specifically, you know, touch on how you think women are affected.
Well, as for women, women are affected in a number of ways, and they are the largest group affected just because they're half of our population. Women are affected by physical abuse, emotional abuse, particularly within fundamentalist homes, marital dissatisfaction in fundamentalist homes, which is actually the opposite of what they typically would claim. Women are affected by education and job opportunities that are affected by sexism. Women's reproductive freedom and health is affected both in mainstream society as the religious right tries to create laws preventing women from having access to birth control measures, but also women in fundamentalist homes, their reproductive freedom is affected, and the reproductive health is in fundamentalist homes. Women are typically—it's typically the idea that sex is for the purpose of procreation, and women have in these homes. I mean, women have a half a dozen or more children quite often. Women's sexual health is affected in fundamentalist homes. There's a high incidence of sexual dysfunction. And even in mainstream society, we're affected by, for example, in Alabama a few years ago, there was a law preventing the sale of vibrators. And I mean, these are just things that seem pretty unheard of, but they do happen.
Do you attribute religious fundamentalism to a predominant cause of sexism?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Do you attribute religious fundamentalism to be a predominant cause of sexism?
Yes, I do. It's a lot of studies have been conducted on this issue, and one of the things that I learned in the research was some of the different causes of sexism. And in conservative homes, it's been found that both men and women have about the same levels of sexism, which you would expect that men would be more sexist than women, pertaining to women's place in the home. That isn't the case. For males, they've found that the affiliation with fundamentalist groups is typically what lends to greater sexism for men. And that really explains the significance of groups such as the Promise Keepers. Men tend to be inclined to form their opinions based on the group's beliefs. And therefore, those who participate, even if they really have initially become involved to become a better father or husband, they end up becoming more patriarchal in their views. For women, the causes of sexism are different. It's been found that in conservative homes and denominations, that it's women's belief in biblical literalism that actually lends to their sexist attitudes. I've pointed out in the book that conservative males also have a tendency to manipulate women into buying these patriarchal views by glorifying the submissiveness of women. And women's role is referred to by fundamentalists as being one of the greatest privileges in the world. So they kind of soften the blow by creating this illusion of specialness of the woman. One of the other reasons that women are seduced into female submission, according to Alice Matthews of the Conservative Baptist Seminary, is that many Christian women hear promises of gratification, and basically her religious convictions are taken advantage of, and then the Bible is used against her to cement those views.
Well, this is going to sound like a big change of topic, but you guys see the time, and I want to keep it all on track. So, without touching that too much, Dr. Buckner, in yep. your best Christian, I mean, in my best Christian impression, I need to know, what have you bastards got against Jesus anyway? Isn't your plea for a secular government just a cover for atheism?
Yes. No, wait a minute. Wait. No, no. Some of us on a personal level, on an individual level, are anti-religious, and I don't think we pretend otherwise. I don't think we are hypocrites. But it is a very different thing to say that the government is secular. And if you read, as I hope you will, all of you in the audience, read Fundamentals of Extremism, you will see in our solutions chapter that we do not condemn all religious people or deny that religious people have a very important part to play in developing a secular nation and in running the secular nation. It's in their best interest as much as it is in ours, and the fundamentalist enemies are not just atheists. The fundamentalists see as enemies liberal, and that should be put in big quotation marks, liberal Christians. So do I personally have anything against Jesus? I don't think he even existed, so I'd have a hard time having anything against him. I do have something against Christianity, at least as it is practiced in many parts of this country and in many parts of the world, by most but not all Christians. But I don't want the government to endorse or encourage my opposition to that. The government has to stay neutral, and that is very much in the best interest of the fundamentalist Christians, of the liberal Christians, and of those of us who are not believers in any of that stuff at all.
I know when people will ask me, what do I have against God, or why am I so anti-God? I'll respond that, you know, atheists are not anti-God any more than they're anti-tooth fairy. We just live our lives without that belief, and those who believe are free to do so, but I'm more concerned with how they treat their fellow human beings than I am with their theological beliefs. then unfortunately a lot of fundamentalists not only want to live their lives a certain way, but want the government to aid them in having others live their lives that same way or denying them some basic human rights.
I think there's a difference between a serious disagreement and a philosophical disagreement. I think many, probably most of all, everybody else on the lines here would agree with me, and I shouldn't speak for them, that religion, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Wiccan, whatever, is faulty in the philosophical areas of logic, that it's faulty in the philosophical area of ethics, and they probably, as I have debates with our religious friends about these philosophical tenets. But this doesn't mean that we want to, that we feel a need to change people's religious beliefs. The difference is with fundamentalists. These people are giving, making a direct threat against us, and fundamentalists of all religions have the potential for essentially the same threat, and it's the threat that was carried out on 9/11/2001. It's the threat that is carried out repeatedly, and that is what the book is about. And the book is about not the philosophy of religion, which in its most benign, in my opinion, is still faulty, but it's about a certain kind of practice of religion that is dangerous.
Before we have to wrap up this segment and get some of the other callers involved, how have you been affected by fundamentalism, Kimberly?
Well, I guess I've had a few experiences. I would say probably my earliest experience when I was growing up, my parents were Methodist. And we went to a pretty mainstream church, and I remember by the time I was probably 7 years old, I really didn't believe in God or Christianity. I had a lot of issues with what Christianity was about at that time. And then a few years later, I think maybe I was around 12, my parents, like probably most people in mainstream churches who haven't experienced fundamentalism, just kind of figured that another Christian church would pretty much have the same teachings. And so we started going to this new Sunday school. We rode the church bus, and my parents didn't attend that particular church, so they weren't familiar with the practices. And one Sunday, rather than going into the Sunday school classes, all the children were brought into the congregation, and we heard the Hellfire and Brimstone lecture, and everyone was called to come up on stage and be saved. And at that time, I was an extremely shy child, and so I would not have gone up there anyways, but on top of that fact, I didn't believe, and therefore I wasn't going to go up and ask to be saved by a God I didn't believe in. And from that time on, I became terrified of the fact that if I died in my sleep, I was going to go to hell. I had, you know, all these contradictory things going in my mind, because on the one hand, I didn't believe, but on the other hand, I had this fear put in me. I would say that was probably one of my first experiences with fundamentalism. And over a period of maybe another 3 or 4 years, I really did finally come to consider myself a Christian. I had such a fear of not believing that, you know, that came to be my belief for a number of years until I became a young adult. And at that point, I read the Bible. And of course, you know, then I was a born again atheist, I guess you could say. But I would say that was probably my first experience with fundamentalism.
It always seems that actually reading the Bible creates a lot of atheists. That's what did it to me as well.
Yeah.
We've got to get Edwin Kagan and John Suarez on the line, and got to release Kimberly and Ed. So Kimberly, it's been a pleasure having you on, and Ed, we'll see you back at the end of the broadcast.
Alrighty. I look forward to it.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kimberly, for coming on and arranging this whole show. Once again, the book is The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America. You can purchase it at newbostonbooks.com. And also, it's featured right now at our website, rationalresponders.com, and it will be for some time. So thanks so much for Kim and Ed. We'll see you in a little bit.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is Richard Carrier, and I support the Rational Response Squad. Be sure to tune in every week.
Thanks for listening to the Rational Response Squad. This spot would be the perfect place for you to advertise your free thought-related business or organization. With rates as low as 2 cents per listener, we blow away the advertising competition. Furthermore, what better way to spread the word than to support an organization fighting to free humanity from the mind disease known as theism? Send a message to rationalresponsesquad@hotmail.com to learn about our rates. Again, that's rationalresponsesquad@hotmail.com. Your ad could be right here in next week's episode.
Visit evolvefish.com. Evolve Fish is the home of the Evolve Fish, a rational response to the Jesus Fish. Evolvefish.com also has plenty of free thought and atheist-related products and tons of liberal stuff as well. Be fully prepared for the Bush impending impeachment. Should it be coming, you will have plenty of bumper stickers and gear from evolvefish.com. So check them out today. Evolvefish.com, once again, home of the Evolve Fish, a rational response to the Jesus Fish.
We're now joined on the line by Bobby Kirkhart, Edwin Kagan, Herb Silverman, and John Suarez.
Thanks for joining the call, John and Edwin. We gave you guys a great bio information earlier, and to save the show some time, we're not going to do that again now, so we can get right into asking you guys questions. And in fact, Edwin, we'd like to start with you. I noticed that you've written a book called The Baubles of Blasphemy. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
It's a collection of blasphemies written by me, poems, letters, articles, essays, so on. Things like referring to Mary Magdalene as a deranged hooker. That got me in some trouble.
Ooh.
The paper reporter said, "Did you really call Mary Magdalene a deranged hooker?" And I said, "Sure did. Did you see where I called the Holy Eucharist swallow the leader?" And the reporter wasn't the same thereafter. The collection of essays published by the Atlanta Free Thought Association and edited, by the way, by Dr. Edward Buckner, your earlier guest, very articulate guest. He's the editor of it.
And we'll bring him back on the line later because I know you guys love jeering with each other.
Okay, he's editor, and he will happily ship you out copies. You can even get one autographed and pay less for it, probably.
Well, you know, but, you touch on Mary.
It's a collection of satires. I think that the best medicine for dealing with some of these things is to laugh at them. And some of them are absurdly funny and can be laughed at. And that's what I do. I satirize. I make fun of them. For example, I demonstrated that the rapture actually occurred as predicted on the stroke of midnight on the year 2000. And that everyone who is going to be raptured has been raptured and is out of here, and that the ones who remain are doomed here for all eternity to have to live by a life of reason. So, and people claiming they're going to be raptured best forget it because it's done and gone. They missed it. They're left behind.
Yeah, you know, Mary was a virgin as long as you don't count anal.
Jeez.
Well, I didn't know. I thought we were on a family-friendly program here, but
didn't you just call her a deranged hooker?
Apparently, though, the God who formed the moral code had no scruples about fooling around with an underage, unwed teenager. But tell that to someone, and they'll say you're committing blasphemy. One of my essays is on the appearance of the Blessed Virgin Mary when a psychic of something in northern Kentucky was saying that the Blessed Virgin Mary was going to appear in the city of Cold Spring, Kentucky. The town name sounded appropriate for a virgin, but people were going out there and seeing things in the sky and so on, looking at the sun and taking photographs of BVM coming from the sun. Always never a good idea to look at the sun with optics, particularly magnifying ones. And so I wrote in the paper and told them that I had been in Canada sitting by a lovely lake and that the BVM appeared to me. I knew it was she, a blonde, blue-eyed Jewish girl dressed in red, white, and blue. And she told me that the story of her appearance was not true, that she didn't make scheduled appearances, but only her father did. And she knew naught of them until they'd occurred. And the paper said that what I was saying was blasphemous. And I said, now, why would you believe the word of an unnamed mentalist or something rather than mine? I'm a lawyer. You know, who would not believe a lawyer? But anyway, they didn't publish it. They really didn't.
I thought
about doing a BVM World Tour t-shirt, you know, Fatima, Medjugorje, Cold Spring, Kentucky. So, but the idea never really caught on.
Well, it does say in the Bible that Mary felt the Spirit of the Lord upon her. So, I mean, they were getting a little raunchy right there on their own. They didn't even need to.
Well, I reckon so. Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote a wonderful short story called Miss Higginbotham Declines, where God decided to have another progeny and to save the world. And he solicited the acquiescence of one Miss Higginbotham of Boston, a virgin of impeccable status. And she said that she would not have any such thing, as far as she understood that she had not heard of any divorce or from his first situation. And even if she had, she would not have any truck with a divorced God. And God pointed out to her that he had made the moral code, you know, and she says, I am that what I am, you know. And so, in other words, her views of morality were superior to God's. Their poems on intelligent design and so on, and on creationism and on fertilized embryos and so forth.
Based on what I'm hearing, the Book of Revelations is going to have to be seriously revised and enlarged.
Well, let me teach you the correct name of the book in the first place. It's not Revelations. It's the Revelation to John. It's not Revelations. And my work on the rapture is called the Revelation to Edwin. Transubstantiation of the world, or the Revelation to Edwin. That's where we reveal that the rapture has occurred.
The transubstantiation
of the world, with the accidents of the world being changed, but not the real substance, just as in the miracle of the Eucharist. And there were certain clues, such as cats were less translucent than usual, and we notice that dogs are mentioned some 30 or so times in the Bible, and cats aren't mentioned at all. And now we know why. Cats have always known. But the way to deal with these people is humor. You can't try to logically reason with mythology. Whose mythology is superior to others? One of the poems in there is called To Lesser Breeds. We think your mythology just one... We think your theology just one more mythology. But something you must never do is treat our theology as some other mythology, because the things we believe in are true. So how do you know? Presbyterians think that Methodists or Baptists who can read, you know. Who knows? A cult is the church down the street from your church, anybody who disagrees with you. And most of the bloodshed and problems confronting the world at the moment are a direct and proximate cause of religion. You find very few born-again atheists on death row. You don't find atheists leading wars or crusades or crime rings. It's born-again Christians. You don't hear of atheists raping little boys. You hear of priests doing it. Why is that? If they make the moral code, if they are the harbingers of all that's good and moral, why are the priests raping the little boys? If gold rusts, what will iron do? Why is this happening, and why do people for a moment tolerate it? It's a good question.
Do you think
about it, you'll go start raving crazy.
I have just some thoughts on my own about that, and I don't have any really test for it, but do you think that has anything to do with the fact that the church prohibits the natural biology of, you know, how we are sexual beings and forces a man to, you know, abstain from sex?
Of course it does. It may be, but also for some reason the Catholic Church attracts a lot of homosexuals. I don't know. They get offended by that, but
yeah, they wear skirts and
you know, they really are out doing the little boys. You know, if you say something that somebody was as excited as a priest at Chuck E. Cheese's, people are going to laugh. Why would they laugh if it weren't true or something? In some of my works, I use the metaphor fast as a or quick as a priest and a choir boy. You know, they are doing it. And then they say things like, well, forgive or you know, understand everybody's entitled to a flaw. It all depends on what point of view they're looking at. They'll condemn drug dealers so Rush Limbaugh gets caught with the Oxycontin, you know, and then that's just somebody who's got a problem. different standards, one for them, one for everybody else.
When they read the book, child sexual abuse has not only a high correlation to fundamentalism, but a high correlation to the idea that all sex is wrong.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And Bobby did a marvelous work on that and also wrote a very nice review of my book, Bibles of Blasphemy. But we're talking about fundamentals of extreme. Now, what was your original question? I may be digressing here.
Oh, we're way off the question, but that's fine.
Good.
It was about the book. But let's move on to John. John, you were the author of the chapter, The Path to Theocracy, The Purgation of the First Amendment. And I'm just curious. And Mike, feel free to weigh in here at any point. But how would you explain intelligent design and explain its threat to the teaching of evolution?
Well, to understand intelligent design, I think we have to get a little bit of a continuum in history. Intelligent design, is that really a theory? It's really an anti-theory. We have, in our society, gone a fair amount in the swing of the pendulum. There was a time when the teaching of evolution was illegal, was not allowed. And we're getting into the 20th century. The Scopes trial, if you remember, had to do with the fact that someone challenged the existing law against teaching evolution. And most people are not aware that even though there were a lot of fireworks and a lot of interesting events in connection with that trial, Scopes himself was found guilty and punished with a token punishment. The teaching of evolution still did not become popular until really the 50s and the 60s, when we decided that science ought to be paid more attention to. And so the curriculum began to include evolution, which of course triggered attempts to at first get rid of it and attack it, and when that wasn't successful, to at least promote the teaching of creationism alongside evolution. That too, by court decisions, was did not survive. And so the creationists reached the point where they realized that they had to be less religious, because that was one of the criticisms in their attempts to teach, say, creation science, and they had to be, quote, more scientific. And that gave rise to what we've been struggling with the last 10 years or so, which is intelligent design. But if you look at it, intelligent design is really not a theory, but only an anti-theory. It devotes itself to the notion that evolution does not explain how we got to be where we are in terms of a development, and therefore there must be an alternate explanation. It's really creationism in a new design, in a new clothing, with the aim of bad mouthing and downgrading and ultimately eliminating evolution. It is a threat because it's really the tip of the iceberg in terms of anti-scientific efforts in our curriculum, and I think that we're going backwards rather than forwards in terms of teaching science and reason.
Would you say that this intelligent design movement is actually indicative of a broader movement against intellectualism in general.
Yes, by all means. I think that we tend to focus on intelligent design because it's tangible. But really, if you look at the efforts, we are really downgrading science. It is very difficult to promote courses in reason and critical thinking in the schools. There is very vast opposition to that. Our science courses are being diluted. And, of course, the current administration is probably the very prototypical of that, in that they are out to change science as whenever it doesn't fit their ultimate agenda. The most telling anti-science evidence is the fact, if you look at fundamentalist textbooks, as was done in a book by Al Menendez many years ago, they take the position that science is okay as long as it doesn't conflict with established theology, but once it does, it has to be discarded and ignored. And unfortunately, that movement is very much, it's creeping into our public school curriculum.
Well, that's their general view overall, that if the data contradicts the dogma, discard the data.
Right. That you're expressing it in a different way, but that's what I was trying to say.
You know, they just throw it out. If the experimental evidence shows otherwise, it's wrong. You want to believe a embryo is a human being, no matter what the evidence. An interesting thing there might be to ask somebody if they were in a burning hospital and they could only save a human baby or 20,000 frozen embryo, which would they save? And watch them ring them bells, see what their answers would be.
I think the effect, the impact on education is very, very frightening, because we're really basically not teaching our children to think independently, to think critically, to rely on reason and science to build their knowledge. And that's the price we're paying for fundamentalist influence in our schools.
And it's the true danger of fundamentalism, I think, too, because what they're really trying to do is replacing critical inquiry and scientific method with medieval views, back to the age of faith. God said it, I believe it, that's that, as some of the bumper stickers say. And that is the real danger. We could, in a generation, be to a point where no one knows anything at all about science. We could have, again, the Middle Ages. You know, when Christianity came along and destroyed the Roman Empire and brought in what's appropriately, in many cases, called the Dark Ages, many of the things that had been known by Greek and Roman science disappeared for 1,000 years, not to be discovered again until the Renaissance. Lots of things, and therein lies the true danger, and why they must be opposed. Not that anybody is mad at God or afraid of Jesus. Right here in northern Kentucky, we have an outfit called Answers in Genesis, and you can read their nonsense on their website, where I mentioned unfavorably a few times, a fact of which I'm very proud. But they are postulating in a $15 million museum that I call the Museum of Nonsense, that humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time. Noah's Ark as a truth, not as a Babylonian myth. And they want to bring school buses full of little children there to learn this, and to refute science. If they teach little children, if your biology school teacher talks about evolution or something that might have happened millions of years ago, just say, "Were you there?" That's their refutation. Were you there?
Why don't we learn critical thinking skills more in school? Why don't we have critical thought classes? It's not because of religion, is it? Or is it?
Oh, yes.
Oh, of course it is. Yes, it's exactly why it is.
I think that we're not aware of the impact that that religion has had in shaping our curriculum, in shaping how we approach things. One would think that with the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason, things would have changed dramatically, but they didn't, because I think the Enlightenment failed, didn't have a broom large enough to sweep away two things that are still bugging our world, one being religion, the other one being royalty. Now, we're not going to get into royalty at the moment, but in terms of religion, we are afraid, I think, in terms of opening up our curriculum to science and reason and critical thinking fully. We're willing to use science as long as it gives us better cars or better vacuum cleaners, but we're not quite ready as a society to use science and reason to look at all the issues that are part of mankind. And the hesitation there, or the block, comes definitely from religion. And we're moving backwards. We're moving back to the Dark Ages.
Yes, but fortunately, America is kind of unique in this among civilized countries of the world. Other nations don't do this, and they laugh at us. They look with the absurdity of our views toward sex, toward science, toward the teaching of creationism. And maybe it is correctly said that Australia got the convicts and America got the Puritans. And we are still suffering from their influence. And if you really want to find out what happened, dear listeners, read the book Fundamentals of Extremism, The Religion, the Christian Right in America, edited by Kimberly Lee Blaker, the book that all of the participants on the show tonight helped co-author. And I think it sets out pretty doggone. Richard Dawkins endorsed it. Do you see his endorsement in the back there? So he really thought it was a page turner.
Yes, that's right, Edwin. Thanks so much. Once again, the book is The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America. You can purchase the book at newbostonbooks.com or amazon.com. It's also featured at our homepage, rationalresponders.com, for a little while. And please support Kimberly and all of the authors by getting involved in their projects and purchasing the book.
And also, please check out Secular Coalition for America and send a little donation their way as well.
That's right. And as usual,
even a big one.
Don't forget to check out our sister sites, freethinkingteens.com, asktheatheist.com, and christmas.com. And until next time, when we are joined again by the authors of The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America, stay rational.